This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead this hour, we'll talk about some of the challenges the pandemic has brought for college towns.
In many of these rural areas and less rural areas, the university is the largest employer in the community. It's a scary story because there are all these factors that kind of play into it being a problem for these communities long after the coronavirus is passed on.
Also, what will it be like to take college classes this fall? And we'll hear about a somewhat forgotten race riot that happened in Illinois more than 100 years ago. That and more coming up on Statewide. Statewide is brought to you by AARP Illinois, providing information to help you and your family when the coronavirus continues to affect us all and keep us apart. More information at aarp.org/near you. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, we'll put a focus on college towns during the pandemic. Many of them are struggling economically, especially as students left town due to COVID-19. While most of the schools plan to have students return soon, there are also health concerns for both students and the overall population in those communities. Also, libraries are starting to reopen while at the same time continuing to expand how they serve the public online. That and more coming up this hour on Statewide. As was mentioned, colleges and universities have been given the go-ahead to reopen campuses for students this fall. Many of the schools have been sharing how they plan to do that. There are still a lot of unknowns, but one thing is for certain. College will look a lot different than it did a year ago. Reporter Kate McGee of WBEZ spoke with Mary Dixon about it.
So a lot of the guidelines we're seeing as restaurants and stores reopen will apply to the college campus. You know, masks must be worn in class, social distancing rules apply, no groups larger than 50. Schools have to figure out traffic patterns so students can walk around hallways without congregating. You know, many are spacing out start times of classes to give students that extra time to get between classes. You know, students can't really pile into a stairwell or an elevator like the same way they used to get from class to class. At many schools, students will be able to elect whether they want to take a particular class in person or online. So teachers are going to be asked to teach in this hybrid model. They could have some students in their classroom and some students watching remotely. So online classes aren't going away, even though in-person classes will resume.
College isn't just about being in a classroom. What are the guidelines going to be for dorm rooms, dining halls, social gatherings?
Many universities say dining halls will have limited occupancy or offer to-go meals. Schools are saying students will be able to return to dorms, but maybe they won't have a roommate or they can't have visitors beyond who lives there. Shared bathrooms will see increased cleanings. And schools will have to designate an area for students who test positive to quarantine for a few weeks in a dorm. The biggest question here is, you know, that schools can set as many rules as they want on campus, but what happens when students leave campus? You know, will students avoid those classic social parts of college, the partying? I spoke with a Loyola University professor, Ruben Keller. He says the success of all of these plans relies on how thousands of students react to them. And this isn't exactly a group known for socially isolating.
So there are all of these plans being put together, which really rely very heavily, I think, upon this group of students to follow some pretty stringent rules for a full semester. That's a big assumption.
It is hard to regulate a kegger. So, Kate, what about faculty and staff? How are they reacting to these plans so far?
So earlier this week, the state released guidance for universities and community colleges to reopen under phase four, and that includes a lot of things that we've already discussed. But a group of faculty unions released a statement expressing disappointment that these plans didn't address those social aspects of campus life and off-campus life really at all, as well as testing. You know, the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign has developed their own test that they plan to use for returning students and throughout the semester. But other schools haven't offered up any plans for testing on campus. And the students' reaction is really a mixed bag. You know, there's a lot of concerns about the risk of returning to campus, but also many students are concerned if classes are still all online, is that really worth the cost? And it still remains to be seen by the time school starts in the fall, whether students will really decide to show up.
What are some other unanswered questions that faculty, students, and students' families might have about how all this is going to work?
A lot of the unanswered questions are logistical. Like, okay, you know, creating traffic patterns so students aren't congregating in the hallways, that makes sense. But what will that specifically look like to a teacher in the building that they teach in? Another issue is, you know, while Illinois has shifted to phase four, colleges enroll students from across the country. What about students who are returning to campus from states where we're seeing upticks in cases? Will they be forced to quarantine first? That really isn't clear at this point. And one question I really haven't seen addressed in these plans is how will these rules be enforced on campus? Whose job is it to tell a student to put their mask on? And what happens if a student refuses? All of that is still kind of remains to be seen and might be developed in the coming weeks or months before school resumes.
That's reporter Kate McGee of WBEZ. She spoke with Mary Dixon. University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign Chancellor Robert Jones warns there will be consequences for students who don't take precautions to mitigate the spread of COVID-19 on and off campus this fall. He made his remarks during a webinar this week with other leaders of Midwest universities. Lee Gaines has more.
Jones says the university is planning a marketing campaign that will encourage students to wear masks and social distance both in the classroom and elsewhere. He says fraternities, sororities, and other campus organizations will be expected to act responsibly when it comes to mitigating the spread of COVID-19. While he hopes the marketing campaign will be effective, Jones says the university also needs to enforce the rules.
There will be consequences for behavior that's antithetical to the kind of environment that we are trying to build about keeping each other safe.
Jones declined to elaborate on what those consequences might be. He says it's a work in progress. I'm Lee Gaines.
The pandemic forced a quick shutdown of college campuses in Illinois and across the country this spring. Students and faculty had to adapt, but it did create financial hardship for towns that house those institutions of higher learning. The schools are at the center of life in those communities. Sean Hubler is the California correspondent for the New York Times, and she wrote about the impact the coronavirus has had on college towns. I spoke with her about it. Sean, I know there have been economic blows to many cities because of COVID-19. Were you surprised at what you found in these college towns?
I suspected that college towns would be feeling some pinch, just because students are a captive market and there are always a certain number of businesses who rely on them for t-shirt sales and book sales and so on. I wasn't prepared for the kind of extent of potential damage. And I was genuinely surprised by how reliant these communities are on campuses. And I shouldn't have been. Of course, these places are in many of these rural areas and less rural areas. The universities are the largest employer in the community, and it's a scary story because there are all these factors that kind of play into it being a problem for these communities long after the coronavirus is passed on.
You wrote about the colleges and universities in many of these towns have really been a stable influence for years. They bring a certain number of people in. They bring jobs in. Towns don't really have to worry about that. And at the same time, now this type of threat, it's really shaking a lot of them to their financial foundations.
It is. For these communities, universities are a great employer. They're good-paying jobs. The people they bring in are stable people. The students are a sort of a life force. They're exciting for a community. There's a lot of turnover. They bring a good vibe. They bring a good element to these. And the employment is usually, the tuition and state support for these schools is usually fairly consistent.
What exactly, from a local government standpoint, did you find as far as the impact the coronavirus and some of these changes are having in these college towns?
Mm-hmm. So a lot of these places rely on sales taxes, of course. So lower sales revenue, lower sales tax revenue, right? Also property taxes. And in some places, for example, in New York State, Cornell and Ithaca, Cornell and Ithaca College are big employers. And Cornell is a big landowner, but Cornell isn't charged property taxes, so they don't have to pay property taxes, and so the community isn't getting that kind of revenue either. Income tax revenue from people who are employed at these universities, and in some places the university employs 10,000 people. In State College, Pennsylvania, the university at the main campus of Penn State is a major employer, and a lot of student jobs are also at the university on campuses, and so the income taxes from that employment also kind of feeds into the community. Also, bed tax. So when there's a graduation, when there's a parent's day, or students are taking the college tour, the local hotels will fill up, and communities rely on that bed tax. All of that revenue is gone.
Now, here in Illinois and many other places across the country, the goal is to try to get students back on campus for the fall, at least in some fashion. Is that going to be enough to stem the tide that you've been talking about?
No, it's not. On campuses where they've tried to some extent to bring students back over the summer, for example, for football practices or fraternity rush or fraternity events, the result has been, in many cases, outbreaks of the virus, and they've had to pull back and send everybody home again. In a lot of the schools, they're going to be bringing students back to some extent. They hope to bring them back to some extent, but the dorms have to be socially distanced, which means that only in many places, a fraction of the students who could be housed on campus can now be housed on campus. The classes are, have to be also socially distanced. So big lecture classes are out, and a lot of universities are trying to kind of figure that out now. How much they're going to be putting classes online and trying some way to get students to come in, maybe like in shifts at a lab and so on. But the bottom line for all of this is fewer people on campus, just because they have to be farther apart and campuses have a finite amount of space.
One other thing you wrote about that I hadn't thought as much regarding this was the 2020 census. Of course, there was a big ramp up to get everybody to participate and fill out their census questionnaires earlier this year, right about the time that all of this happened, that we saw students being sent home and campuses closing down. That has an impact on these college towns as well, doesn't it?
Oh, it's heartbreaking. Talk about timing being everything. These communities rely on the headcount in the annual census, and the headcount relies on the students being in the community. If they don't have the responses that they need, their official population count drops. And that's really important because the census people tend to know, well, the census determines sort of your representation in Congress and certain other things, but it also is the threshold for a lot of federal funding and many federal grants. And so, for example, there are some communities where if their population falls below, say, 100,000 population, they're ineligible for all sorts of federal grants that they had relied on before to pay for police forces, and senior centers, and streetlights and potholes and all sorts of things that that these communities need to remain functional. In some communities, they're already sort of looking ahead to see where they can cut and what they can do without, not just in the short term, but in the long term. The census is giving people more time, and there are extra efforts being undertaken, and many states are trying to get in there and backfill and make sure that everybody has every opportunity to respond to the census. But I will say, just sort of as a public service announcement for people who live in college towns, if you haven't responded to the census yet, you really should.
And these towns just don't seem the same right now, do they?
I think the saddest thing for me was just an appreciation of how much life and how much togetherness has been lost in these communities. A college town has been, for people who live there, a place where, culture and art and music and you know, learning, all of these things are accessible. And that's one of the reasons people love to live there. Just the sense of life, the farmer's market in Davis, for example, or the bookstores and student, you know, and delis in Ann Arbor is lost because when people go, we can't be together. And I think one of the things about this pandemic has been the way that it has made all of us just so keenly aware of how much we miss contact and how much we miss connectedness. Universities connect us and university towns connect us. So much gets lost. As, you know, one of the folks that I interviewed said, you know, the squirrels are having a field day, but for the rest of us, it's just so quiet. And I think that's a sad thing.
Sean Hubler is the California correspondent for the New York Times. She wrote about college towns and the impact that they're feeling due to COVID-19. A link to her article can be found at our website at statewideshow.com. Among those college towns that have been suffering is Carbondale, home to a Southern Illinois University campus. Mayor Mike Henry spoke with WSIU Radio about the problem.
You know, a lot of our restaurants and our bars were able to get some help from the federal government and state government, which the city hosted the loans, and they're forgivable loans. So we're hoping that helped them through the toughest period. And but we definitely need to get our students back in town and get the other folks that come with the student population back in town. And I think we'll pick up. But we've had significant tax revenue losses. Also, the city has. And, of course, our businesses have had substantial revenue losses.
As for his city, Henry says he's optimistic things are picking up again. Support for Statewide comes from AARP Illinois, providing information that can help you and your family when the coronavirus continues to affect us all and keep us apart. More information at aarp.org/near you. Still ahead on Statewide, getting students back to campus is important in college towns, but what about the health risks for the rest of the community? We'll hear more on that. That's next. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, the coronavirus behind bars, what data shows about testing in prisons, and getting libraries open once again. That and more still to come. Up next, many universities are preparing to welcome back students for on-campus learning this fall during the pandemic. Even with safety protocols in place, many believe keeping students, staff, and community members safe is going to be a challenge. Dr. Sheldon Jacobson is a professor of computer science at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and he spoke about it with Mary Dixon.
So you have written an op-ed for the Indy Star saying university towns are poised to become the next COVID-19 epicenters and that schools need to consider the health of their host communities. What do you mean by that?
Well, university towns, small and medium-sized, have a very intimate, at sometimes antagonistic relationship with their town. It's the so-called town-gown divide. And what we've tried to look at and analyze is that as the schools, basically after spring break, asked their students not to come back, they spared these communities from COVID-19 surges. Well, these schools are now bringing their students back. And as a result of that, the people who live in the communities are very, very vulnerable to high infection rates. And that's the concern that I saw and what I wrote about in the op-ed, to try and point out that there has to be much more of a community relationship and decision-making process when university towns and the universities within them come back together. If it's done unilaterally, it's a formula for disaster.
You've written that students could overwhelm hospitals and clinics. What do you think these schools and communities need to do to prepare for students' return?
Well, when the students come back, they're in the age group that although they may get infected, the likelihood of bad outcomes is very, very small. Unfortunately, they use the same public transportation. They eat in the same restaurants. They shop at the same grocery stores. They live in multi-unit buildings, and they will infect the community residents. The students may not even know that they're infected, but the people who they are interacting with in the community, who are in their 40s and 50s and 60s and beyond, they are more likely to have bad outcomes.
You're in the Urbana-Champaign area. Have you heard from neighbors who are concerned about the return of students?
I've heard both from neighbors as well as from people on campus who are older faculty and staff. Many universities around the country are bringing their students back because of the economics. They cannot survive. In-person education has tremendous value, and you can, in fact, charge a premium for it over online education. If we don't bring the students back, we being all of these university towns, then they're degrading the value of what they offer. So bringing the students back is critical. But how you bring them back and the expectations are absolutely some of the most important issues, and as well as dealing, of course, with the host communities.
That is the other part of this dilemma, where these university towns do need those dollars from those kids going into the restaurants and the drugstores. And you know, what would you say to those who are not so concerned about being careful?
Well, the students are 18 to 24 typically, and by definition, they're going to be students. Universities are not designed for social distancing. You know, the very thesis of higher education is to bring people together. Now we're asking them to not only come together, but to physically stay apart. And that is completely inconsistent. You know, we're entering a phase of the Wild West of higher education this upcoming fall. We have over 5,000 institutes of higher education in the United States, and approximately 60% are committed to some form of in-person education. That's thousands of students in each of these universities, millions of students around the country, many of which coming to these small and medium-sized towns. The residents, I don't know if they realize what's going to be hitting them, because the students aren't the ones who are going to get sick. It's going to be the older people.
We are starting to hear from schools, from administrators outlining their plans for teaching in person, including the administrators of the University of Illinois. So this is personal for you. Do you think that the measures the U of I are taking, are they going to be enough?
The measures that are being proposed by the University of Illinois, as well as every other university, are very standard. Follow the CDC guidelines. Take your temperature each day. Notice your health. Hand hygiene is critical. Social distancing, wearing masks. These are all standard. But it misses one important component, and it's not unique to the University of Illinois. It's true of just about every university. They're trying to prevent the students from being infected. And that is, for all intents and purposes, impossible. The students are going to get infected. The key is to protect all the people who are vulnerable, who have a higher risk of a bad outcome. You know, one of the things that I've thought about and proposed and talked about this back in April is bring the students back, but the vulnerable faculty and staff, have them work remotely, literally having faculty members deliver in real time their lectures to a room full of students. But the real challenge is the community residents. The university has some measure of control over its staff and faculty, but it has very little control over the residents. And that's why openings have to involve mayors, it has to involve town councils, and it has to involve the local healthcare infrastructure. And if it does not do this, it is a formula for disaster at every small and medium-sized university town in this country.
I have one final question, and that is, how did a professor of computer science decide to go public with these concerns? It seems like this is something you'd hear about from someone in public health or medicine.
I've been working on data problems related to public health for over 25 years. At the University of Illinois, we don't have a school of public health, so I've been a little bit of an outlier here, but I've applied ideas from risk-based thinking to address public health and public policy problems. And I've written on this and done work with this for, you know, a quarter of a century. See, the challenge is that there's no how-to book written to do this. Nobody knows how to open a university. Nobody knows how to open a town. We know how to close them. We did that in March. But now we have to open them. And the how-to guide is being written in real time. And I do believe that there is a path which is optimal to get us through this. But nobody knows what it is yet, and we're going to discover it by trial and error.
Dr. Sheldon Jacobson, professor of computer science at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Hundreds of inmates and staff members inside Illinois prisons have contracted COVID-19 since the pandemic began. At least 13 have died. Now the Department of Corrections is dealing with an outbreak of the illness at the East Moline Correctional Center. According to data obtained by Illinois Newsroom, IDOC has only conducted about 950 tests as of a couple of weeks ago, and there are more than 30,000 people in state prisons. The University of Illinois Institute for Government and Public Affairs recently published a report that encourages the prison system to expand testing of inmates, among other recommendations. Lee Gaines spoke with two authors of the report, Sage Kim and Robin Fretwell Wilson, about why testing for the virus is so important.
I mean, I think that testing is fundamental to mitigating outbreak and spread, because we have to know who has COVID-19, right? And then you can actually follow with, you know, isolating and, you know, moving these people from the general prison population. So one thing off the bat we actually discuss in our report is that when prisons in other states started actually testing widespread tests and also, you know, antibody tests that they were implementing, that has been really useful tool to figure out where we are and actually come up with interventions to deal with it. So I think testing is one big issue that we can actually, you know, make it better now that we, you know, as a whole state have a better testing capacity.
Do we have any idea why so few COVID-19 tests have been conducted inside state prisons, especially now when the general population of Illinois seems to have fairly easy access to testing?
We kind of are trying to look inside of what's a difficult problem from the outside. The key is to get as many tests as we can in place to move outside of just testing people who are symptomatic to people who are asymptomatic. We'll get at something closer to a truer rate of what the actual, you know, concern inside of the population inside the prison is. But we also recognize in the report that there's scarcity. And it's incredible to think about how far we've come from the beginning of COVID-19, the beginning of outbreaks and congregate care, to being armed with, you know, some tests to be able to tamp down outbreaks as they're happening. You can see East Moline is in the middle of an outbreak, and lots of our resources need to be thrown that way, obviously.
I'm wondering, how can the spread of the virus within jails and prisons affect an outside community?
Prisons are not isolated from surrounding communities. Inmates coming out of prison all the time, and also staff coming in every day to serve the prison population. So I think there is this very porous relationship between the Illinois Department of Corrections and then the surrounding communities. It's both spilling over outbreak inside going out to the community, but also, you know, surrounding communities, you know, infection and how well those are contained also affect what would happen inside prisons.
I think we have a tremendous amount that we can learn from them. You know, one of the things that we note in the report in Cook County Jail is how many people have recovered. I think one of the things that we have to be sure to do is distill from people's experiences as they're happening, what they are doing that can be constructive for all of us. So I think we have a vested interest in understanding what's happening with the prison population, with understanding what's happening with the prison staff, right? Because that porous border that Sage talked about, that's people going in and out of the jail. That's the staff.
That's Robin Fretwell Wilson, director of the University of Illinois Institute for Government and Public Affairs. And we also heard from Sage Kim, a professor at UIC. They spoke with reporter Lee Gaines about the impact of COVID-19 on the state's prison and jail populations. Well, public libraries are working to open up their facilities once again, even as they expand their offerings online. Chase Kavanaugh has that story.
When the governor's stay-at-home order went into effect mid-March, most businesses and nonprofits temporarily shut down. Jen Barton, the director of Genoa Public Library, said there wasn't any specific guidance in the order for libraries.
It's been sort of a trial and error process through the whole being closed. Are we essential? Are we not essential? What can we do if we are closed? And then how do we go about reopening and still being safe?
Some libraries also had outstanding materials when they closed their doors. But when they closed completely, they worked to shift services to a virtual context. DeKalb Public Library Director Emily Faulkner says they teamed up with Hoopla, an online streaming service for media such as audiobooks, movies, and magazines.
Since nobody was able to get print books for a month or two, we thought it was a better use of the funds to have things that were available from home using that money. So that was a new relationship.
Sycamore Library already had a contract with Hoopla, but Director Monica Dombrowski says they've also been taking physical events online.
We created a YouTube channel while we were closed, which isn't something we had before. We started offering a lot of things through Facebook Live, doing some recorded programs that we could post up.
These can range from guest speakers to full-blown story times. For this, Dombrowski says employees stocked up on material from the library for recording.
So they, you know, grab all the books and take them home, and then they're doing a song. You know, they're doing some little hand movements and body movements, and then they're doing a story.
That video could then be uploaded online. In Sycamore's case, Dabrowski says people have been quite receptive, with the videos even gaining an audience out of state. Faulkner says DeKalb also offers themed story times.
So you tune in and Batgirl will read you a story, or, you know, you'll get Ariel telling you all about what it's like under the sea.
Once restrictions began to loosen, some libraries began to offer curbside pickup. This allows patrons to reserve specific books without having to enter the library. Librarians can also help people find specific books in a genre they like, or even point them to something entirely new. The process runs smoothly, but once materials come back, Dabrowski says they need to be quarantined.
One of our meeting rooms is literally a table for every day of the week, and then all of the items that get returned have to go on that table for the duration of the quarantine period.
Originally, this was an entire week before books could be checked out again. But a recent library study says that can now be as few as 72 hours. Now, libraries such as Sycamore are planning the reopening of their buildings to the public. Dombrowski says this has patrons excited.
They've come up to the front of the glass since we've been back in the library and, you know, brought us cookies and signs and said, "We miss you," and we miss them just as much.
DeKalb Library has already opened, though they had to shut down some areas, such as specialized reading rooms. They can still offer access to computers and other in-library services that involve fewer people. Faulkner says that includes browsing the shelves.
You know, the same way you go to a grocery store, you can never be totally sure that that box of Lucky Charms hasn't been touched by, you know, the guy who just walked down the aisle before you. But we're really hoping that we can minimize that and make people feel safe.
Sycamore plans to open next week, and Genoa is looking at how it would reopen its doors. Director Barton says in the long term, libraries can apply what they've learned during the pandemic.
We're kind of exploring how we can provide more services in a virtual way, but perhaps also having the opportunity for people who may not choose to do it virtually still have a similar access.
But regardless of whether the libraries are open, have yet to open, or are just making plans, Faulkner says overall, the community views them as valuable resources.
I have to say, I mean, I always knew people loved the library, but it wasn't until they started leaning out of their cars to yell at me while I was gardening about it that I realized how much they missed us.
And they all look forward to meeting their patrons in person. I'm Chase Kavanaugh.
The Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan this week announced he's calling for removal of a couple of statues on the lawn of the Illinois State Capitol building in Springfield. The monuments are to men with racist pasts. Madigan says he wants both a statue outside the Capitol and portrait inside of former U.S. Senator Stephen Douglas removed. Madigan says he wants to remove an unnecessary reminder of the nation's past. Douglas believes slavery was an issue best left up to each territory. He defeated Abraham Lincoln in a Senate race. The Douglas portrait in the House would be replaced by one of Barack Obama. On the lawn, Madigan wants a Douglas statue removed along with a statue of the first Lieutenant Governor, Pierre Menard, which shows him standing above a Native American. The House Speaker also wants to give a statue of Martin Luther King Jr., currently across the street from the Capitol, a more prominent location. He'll ask for a House vote in the fall. In the meantime, he says he's looking into ways to cover the Douglas portraits and a review of other statues, portraits, and symbols on the Capitol grounds. Still on the way, we'll look back at a violent summer more than a century ago. This is Statewide. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead, we'll remember a violent summer in Chicago. This fall, Amtrak is reducing the number of overnight trains that are passing through Illinois. That's going to mean less service for communities like Carbondale, Champaign, and Springfield. Bill Wheelhouse explains.
Amtrak says fewer riders are on those interstate routes because of COVID-19. A group which advocates for service says while that may be the case, the rail line's route cuts will end up giving passengers in the towns along the routes fewer daily train options. Jim Matthews is head of the National Rail Passenger Association.
And if the Congress says that it is important to have a fully functioning long-distance network for the entire country, then that's what the federal government is paying for. That is what the taxpayer is paying for, and that's the system they should operate.
Amtrak will cut those overnight long-distance rail service routes from 7 days a week to 3 days a week starting October 1st. I'm Bill Wheelhouse.
After the police killings of Ahmaud Arbery and George Floyd, Anthony McGill sat down to write about his sadness. McGill is the principal clarinetist of the New York Philharmonic Orchestra. He was raised on Chicago's South Side. His online message sparked other musicians to use their art as a form of protest. Carrie Shepard brings us that story.
At first, McGill's response was a powerful written statement, but that didn't feel quite right. He picked up his clarinet.
If I was going to make this statement publicly, it would be strange to do so without sharing how I communicate with the world normally, which is through music.
McGill's wife suggested America the Beautiful, and that felt like the music for the moment.
To think about the freedoms that we hold dear and how sometimes we're not allowed to, or people say we're not allowed to express those same freedoms.
After the 1 minute and 15 second performance, McGill silently drops to his knees. That's a nod to former 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick kneeling during the national anthem and what's become a symbol of resistance to systemic racism. McGill invited others to post messages with the hashtag #TakeTwoKnees. Opera singers, dancers, composers, and youth orchestras submitted performances, all punctuated with them kneeling at the end. The response reminded McGill that artists have a voice beyond their music. They have a platform to call for justice.
We do have a lot of power. In our ability to express and reach people, they may be curious about what we feel as well and how we can help communities move forward.
Carrie Shepard with that report. In 1919, there was a race riot that took place in Chicago. It left nearly 40 people dead. It's the focus of a book, and the author, Claire Hartfield, hopes her work, titled A Few Red Drops, will bring some new awareness to an event that was forgotten by many. Brian O'Keefe spoke with her. We bring you that conversation.
The date was July 27, 1919, a day that would forever change the life of John Turner Harris and cause the whole city of Chicago to rethink where it had been and where it was headed. As is often the case just before catastrophe strikes, that Chicago summer Sunday morning was like any other, carrying no hint of the trouble ahead. Except that it was hot. the unbearable humid kind of hot that sits heavy on the chest and covers the skin with a glistening film of sweat before the day has a chance to get started. The air in 14-year-old John's bedroom in his family's home in the city's Black Belt was thick with the smell of animal blood that drifted east from the city's stockyards a few miles away. By the height of the day, temperatures would soar to 96 degrees, 14 degrees above normal, and this heat had been building for days.
That's Chicago-based author and historian Claire Hartfield reading from A Few Red Drops. It recounts the violent 1919 race riot in Chicago. She traced the nightmarish events to an incident that happened when then 14-year-old John Harris and four other boys sought relief from the heat in the cool water of Lake Michigan.
In Chicago, segregation was not a legal issue. Beaches were open, parks were open, restaurants were open to everyone. The reality of it is that everybody knows, you know, blacks don't go here, they don't go there. And there is still some of that today, I think, although it's much more subtle. But in any event, so the boys started out at what was called the Black Beach, which was about a half a mile from the White Beach, and floated out into the water and were just playing. And they didn't notice that they had slipped over that invisible line. In Chicago, under the law, most places were open to both blacks and whites. Children attended school together and adults rode streetcars together. Under the law, blacks and whites could choose to eat in the same restaurants and get tickets to shows in the same theaters. Even so, many places were segregated, with the races separated by an invisible line. The beaches were like that. The boys knew, everybody knew. Blacks frequented the beach at 26th Street. Whites swam at the beach on 29th Street. That in itself, I don't think, would have been the blow up, but at this simultaneously on the White Beach, two black couples came and just decided to make it a beach day for themselves. And that was a statement, I think. Now, in looking at the history, I can't definitively say what was in the minds of those couples, but certainly within the context of this new, we can come and go and do whatever we want, that was the implication of it. So the whites on the beach, who, this was their beach, some of them were not happy about it, and they began throwing stones at the black couples. The black couples left for a little bit, came back with more blacks. So you see these tensions building up. Meanwhile, one white guy sees the kids floating over and starts to throw stones at them and hits one of them in the head and he drowns. And so there you have an incident which could have been tragic but small, blow up into something big because these things came together. The final piece of the beach scene, which I think might resonate a little bit with today, is that everybody could see this white guy who had stoned the kids. And so they identified him to a white policeman on the beach, and the white policeman refused to arrest him. And so that just became a powder keg, and it went boom. 1919 was actually called Red Summer because there were tens and twenties of riots around the country that summer. And they all really stemmed from some particular incidents back then that really just set off a series of events. After that, there was a little tension for a while, but then in the 20s, things settled down. Of course, then there was the war. And then, of course, in the 50s, things were relatively quiet, but they started to percolate again. Then you erupt again in the 60s and 70s. You have a downswing again, and now things are coming to a head again. So I think there are cycles in history that you can see, and that wasn't the first one necessarily, but it was certainly a big one, that cycle, around 1920.
For Hartfield, there was an even more personal connection to the story of the Red Summer. It was something she heard directly from her grandmother.
When I was younger, she told me of how she had been a young woman herself and had just moved from New Orleans up to Chicago. And she got herself an apartment in the black community and a job in a factory in the industrial community. And she loved life here. And then one hot summer day in 1919, she was boarded the streetcar at work to come home. And as they got closer and closer to the black community, she looked out her window and she saw these mobs of young men, black and white, throwing stones at each other, fighting in the streets, you know, really kind of rushing the streetcar. And the streetcar driver was scared and so went straight to the end of the line and let everybody out there. And she was far from home and had to walk back home through all of these mobs. So it was something that stuck with her, and she you know, was really, really scared. So she made it home safely. But she told me this as one of her stories of Chicago.
The memory of that story from her childhood came to the forefront for Hartfield last summer as she again saw racially charged demonstrations and violence in cities around the country.
So my whole career has been in education, and I've always had a passion for young people, children and teenagers and, you know, young adults is what I would say. So I wanted to write something in an area for them that hasn't really been written about, but that's relevant to today because they know what's going on. It's not that they don't know what's going on, but it's sometimes hard to have a context for it. And my hope is that by reading this, it will help them to kind of sift through their own lives. And I'm hopeful too that the adults in their lives will also read it and talk to them about it, whether it's parents or teachers or other mentors that they have, and help them sift through the issues and then also encourage them to be active and not paralyzed by what's going on today, but encourage them, say, let's think of some ways that you can make a difference. I think that's really important. And if they start young, by the time they do replace us, they will have the tools, I think, to really try to make a difference in the world. A lot of the same hopes and fears that immigrants today are feeling in terms of moving resonated back then. So, you know, nobody wants to up and leave your home, all your things, all your friends. But at the same time, there's this hope of a better future in the move. And I think it was that kind of yin and yang that was present there.
The reason I kind of laid that groundwork is I wonder if this, well, I was about to say clearly race-based. Mm-hmm. I wonder if it offers some lessons about this tension that we're dealing with now that is not necessarily race-based, but immigrant-based.
Right. And I think it is. I think that people have a fear of change, and particularly those people who have a lot to lose or think they have a lot to lose. So they are afraid of change. They're afraid of what new people coming into their space may do to them. Well, I saw the parallels myself. I tried to mostly present the facts on both sides because I believe that the way people learn is through knowing the facts and then drawing their own inferences. So I don't think I was too heavy-handed in trying to say, this is what happened then, this is what's going on now.
But that's exactly why I asked the question, because I wonder, do you feel like you have to make sure people see there's a like, do you feel like you need to be walking around with a sign that says, there's a parallel here?
Right. There are some people who've given me feedback and read it, and actually they're the ones who come to me and say, the initial reaction is, wow, I never knew this happened. And this has so many contemporary parallels, so I don't even have to bring it up. So I think my experience is, anyway, that people will see it. I'm hopeful that in teaching institutions that they can use it as a tool.
Even though many people don't know the story of Chicago's 1919 race riot, Hartfield's research into the events and the aftermath found that it was, at least for a time, a transformational event in the city's history.
One of the things that they did in the aftermath of this is they had a perfect opportunity to point fingers and say, this was you. And there was a little bit of that in mentioning some of the white gangs that were really a heavy part of this. But they put together a commission of 6 blacks and 6 whites to really dive into what happened here and to give some recommendations about going forward. It's a 650-page document, and it goes into every reason that you could possibly think of. But most importantly, it really says we are all part of this, not just the people who were immediately in the riot, but all of us in the city, the media, the politicians, you know, everyday people, church, all of those. And then it calls upon people to come together and unite.
That's Brian O'Keefe talking with the author Claire Hartfield about her book, A Few Red Drops. It examines a 1919 race riot that took place in Chicago. That's all the time we have for Statewide. Thanks for joining us, and be with us next time for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. And a reminder, you can find all of our episodes at statewideshow.com, and our podcast is available through the NPR One app. Statewide is brought to you by AARP Illinois, providing information to help you and your family when the coronavirus continues to affect us all and keep us apart. More information at aarp.org/near you. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois public radio stations. Thank you.